You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
On today's show, we're not just speaking to a professional. We are encountering a woman who has spent her life turning courage into a compass and service into a calling. See, some people follow career paths and others carve corridors of change. Tasneem Fredericks is one of the rare ones, a qualified attorney, a social entrepreneur, a transformation activist, an advocate for women's empowerment. But these are just titles. And titles are far too small for a woman whose life has been nothing less than rewriting what is possible for those who were never expected to rise. Tasneem is not shaped by the system. Oh, she confronts it. She doesn't bend to ceilings. She breaks them. And she does not wait for inclusion. What she does is build spaces where women can walk in and belong. Her journey is not a straight line of success. It is a tapestry of lessons, reinventions, redirections, and holy resilience. Every chapter in her story reads like a woman who chose purpose over comfort, courage over fear, and justice over silence. Tonight, she's not here as a guest. She is here as a mirror for every woman who has ever climbed, stumbled, risen, and kept going. Tasneem, welcome to Business Sense.
Good evening, Pumi, and to your audience, and thank you for having me again.
Oh, it's so beautiful to have you here. Yeah, go ahead.
Now, I was going to say I was previously interviewed by Tapelo
in
2023. So when Bongi reached out to me, I must tell you, I am super exhausted like many South Africans this time of the year. But I, you know, I was encouraged because I had so much fun the last time. And
I'm happy that you're saying like most South Africans, because here's the truth. December in South Africa is not December. It's not the same as December everywhere else in the world. I was shocked when a friend of mine was saying, yeah, tomorrow, and this was the day after Christmas, I'm going into work. Uh-huh. And I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean? So it's true. We're all so exhausted. So I'll try to inject this conversation with some life so we don't doze off, number one, but also we don't put people to sleep. Yeah?
Absolutely. 100%. I'm with you. All the way in.
Let's go.
All the way in.
Let's go. So Tasneem, when you look back at your younger self, what early moment told you that you were never meant to live a small life?
You know, Mpumi, thank you so much for that question, because I actually find myself, you know, it's my anchor. Mm. The story of why I grew up thinking that I was special and I wasn't ordinary stems from the confidence that my dad gave me. Mm. You know, he truly believed in me when I didn't even know that that was a construct, that that was a thing. Mm. You know, I was really little. I must have been around, I don't know, 6 or 7 years old. Mm. And, you know, he often, so I'm Muslim by religion, and my dad taught me Arabic before I even learned English in school. And so he teach me little prayers, really. It wasn't conversational Arabic. He teach me prayers. And, you know, whenever he had his friends around, and we come from a very conservative, traditional background, where men and women are separate, and traditionally the women are in the kitchen raising the families. Yeah. Nobody, as I don't come from an era of women who aspired to be, you know, presidents and CEOs of companies. Mm. You know, I come from an apartheid era. In fact, where, you know, but besides discrimination that Black people endured, there was, you know, the gender margin was so much more. It was so much wider.
Yeah.
So my dad would do this thing where his male friends would come and visit and they'd sit in the lounge and be served, and he'd call me, you know, as a little girl, and he'd ask me to, you know, recite a prayer.
Yeah.
And these men would applaud me at the end and you know, and say, beautiful, you know, what a beautiful recitation. So my dad really instilled confidence in me amongst men at an age where, you know, so I grew up thinking that it was normal as a little girl to be confident and not to be afraid of authority, and that boys were better than girls, or that men were better than women. So that, I think, to me is such an important lesson to the fathers out there. That and you know, you can be a father without being a blood relation. You can be the uncle, or you can be the cousin, you know, the older cousin or the older brother in the house. And really to just instill in that little night, that little 7-year-old that looks up to you, to confidence. I think that's the main, you know, that's the main thing for me, that my dad believed in me. He's late now. He passed away in 2020,
Sorry
but
about
I
that.
cherish those. No, I don't feel as sad as I used to, because I feel he's still with me, and that I feel he is looking down and smiling and saying, "That's my girl," you know.
Oh
And that
man.
brings a smile to my face. So I don't feel sad that he's not here anymore. I feel like he's done the most with the time that we had together. So yeah, that's my story.
And
I
so you became an attorney. And I'm
became
so curious.
an
Yeah, I'm so
attorney.
curious about because not only did you become an attorney, you also became so much more, which makes sense because you had a father who made you believe there is absolutely nothing you can't do, whether privately or publicly. Tell me, what did the law teach you about the world? And what did the world teach you about the law? Or maybe let me say, what is the other still teaching you about the other?
Yeah, so I must be honest with you. You know, coming from the apartheid era, you know, kids today, they have so much access to information. They've got so much, you know, you have these job shadowing, and you have, you know, guidance and counseling at school, life LO is what they call it, life orientation. We didn't really have that back in the day. talking about the early 90s, you know, before apartheid. So I didn't really know what I wanted to study as a career, but I was more, I was leaning towards the creative side. And as any young woman, you know, loved fashion, loved design. And I indicated to my parents, you know, that I would like to go into that field. And you know, I'll never forget my parents saying to me, no, you are not going to go all the way to university to study a hobby. So, you know, throughout my high school career, my parents were very big on education, and they said to me, "You must have maths, must have physics, must have accounting, and of course, everything on higher grade, what we called then higher grade. I think now it's called, you know, maths higher grade. Probably today it's called maths pure, and then you get maths lit, which is the equivalent of standard grade." So, I mean, I had the subjects that could have taken me into accounting, into pharmacy, into medicine. But I was really into journalism. I mean, I would pretend to be reading the news at night. So that was, you know, the entertainment and kind of artsy, you know, that was the world that I envisaged for myself. But at the same time, I was very active in the social justice space. I was part of the student representative council at high school, and we had regular, you know, we were very active politically, and we had regular walkouts and demonstrations in the quads, you know, during break time. So there was that element of social justice, that, you know, it was a spark in me. But I didn't think about being a lawyer, because I, you know, most of my family were teachers or nurses, you know, the normal industries that were reserved for black people in this country. So I started out, you know, but what I did know is that I wanted to study what it was I didn't know. And of course, I ended up, you know, standing in a queue, not knowing what, looking what other people were entering. And I actually did first year because I wanted to do journalism, and I didn't have that at what was then called UPE, now Nelson Mandela University. I thought I would, you know, do a BA and major in language. So I took French, and I took English, but I also took psychology and social work. And during that last part of that first year, during my BA, I remember the social work lecturer coming in and saying to us, "You know, if you want to do social work, if you want to do psychology, just remember this is not for anybody who wants money. This is for people who really just, you know, because you're not going to get paid a lot. And I thought to myself, now why the hell am I taking two taxis every morning?
Yes.
You know, to make that quarter to eight class, and I'm not going to make money.
Yeah.
So that put me off.
Yeah.
And I think I found myself one way or the other choosing law, and that first year that I did law, it spoke to me so deeply and it moved me so much that I knew this is, you know, I had found my groove. And I specialize in property law, in conveyancing, which is also something very close, I think, to every Black South African's heart, is to own land in this country, to own a home.
Yes.
And I still see title deeds today that speak about 99-year leases because, you know, Black African people could never own land. And I see, I still today see title deeds that say colored people can only sell to other colored people. So, you know, I feel like there's so much history in what I do, specifically because it's got to, to do with the land. And I learn every day. I mean, I wake up not knowing what the day is going to hold and what I'm going to learn. So I have an open heart and an open mind in terms of just being open to learn new things every day or learn how to do things better every day. So for me, I found, you know, law just fit with my character. It blended in with the other avenues that I ended up doing. I'm very strong on, you know, the Palestinian Solidarity Fund front. I was the two former deputy president of the Black Management Forum, which, you know, which is, it lobbies for transformation, for building a strong Black middle class and for the economic transformation of Black people in this country, because, as you know, we are still the economic minority. Yeah. So I think, you know, being in the legal field really just opens your mind on how to deal with these issues that are bread and butter issues for all of us, you know, the majority of us living in this country.
So, Snima, I can imagine that you didn't just share the stats around white people owning land for about 99 years and colored people only being eligible to sell to other colored people. Is there a reason why you highlighted that, perhaps, or is there something you are doing to change that and to sort of initiate a reform in that region or in that area?
Look, I mean, I also served as a second deputy president to the Black Conveyancers Association, which, you know, it's open to, well, the membership is open to all, but you know, Black conveyancers in this country, it's so hard to pass the conveyancing exam, number one, and there's so few of us. And then when we do make it and we apply to be on panels of banks, you know, it's not something to get into very easily because, you know, a lot of the developers in the country are still, you know, the majority are white, and so it's their community that they are going to say, and, you know, and this isn't unusual in anything you do. You know, so that access to transferring land and to being part of that economy, because it's probably one of the more lucrative legal professions to be in than the ordinary. I mean, if you're going to, and I mean, I want to say this is that, you know, you gave me a very warm introduction and you spoke about, you know, being bold, you know, being courageous, forging paths, breaking ceilings. I don't think that I was deliberate about doing those things. I think, you know, even opening my own business was by, you know, and a lot of Black professionals, legal professionals, don't become CEOs of the of their companies by, you know, intentionally. You know, it's by default because we can't get into other companies, or we, after articles, we find ourselves out there in the cold, and we don't have anything else to do but open our own company. So a lot of these things happen by default, and of course, I you know, eventually it becomes more intentional. But you know, the scales of justice is very much unequal in that regard still. So I think, to me, you know, the land issue and the fact that we had such a peaceful transition means that there was a there's a reason for that. There was a compact made between, you know, the government incoming at that point with white South Africans at large, corporate specifically, and so issues like affirmative action, Black economic empowerment were things that we took in lieu of the land. We settled as Black people for that. And I think, being aware of that, being conscious of that, and reminding ourselves that we are experiencing the fruits of people who never saw the fruits of their labor. And that labor hasn't ended. So it is our responsibility and our duty to ensure that we don't want to have these conversations with, we don't want our grandchildren and their grandchildren to be having the conversation around why does the economy still lie in the hands of the minority? As an African, as an African country on an African continent, we're not in Europe. So we should not be facing issues of poverty.
100%. You know what I've learned is that for every transformation activist has a turning point. And I'm curious about what event or experience ignited that fire in you.
I think for me, we grew up pretty much, when I think back on my childhood, I don't feel we were particularly poor simply because we all had broken shoes. We all walked to school.
It was so normal.
It was normal. It was pretty much normal. But I do remember my grandmother telling us stories about having being forcibly displaced and removed from the District 6 of Gqeberha, of having, been given notice to move, but being deliberate about not moving and really just resisting the 1956 Group Areas Act. And I think for me, it was, it was about that history of where I came from and the stories about the injustice around what happened. Because, if you look at the there was no real reparations for Black South Africans. So for me, it was, that was the turning point. It was about, who we are, who I am rather, where I come from, and what, what did my ancestors have to forego and give up so that I could be the first in my family to graduate, so that I could have the financial freedom to make decisions about where I want to go on holidays out of the country, for example, and to ensure that, I could then lift the rest of my family, out of, because really and truly the only thing that breaks poverty is education. And not everybody has the same access. And even if they have the same access, they may not have the same opportunities.
Women empowerment. I want us to talk about women empowerment because it gets such bad rep. There's been this thing on social media about, the mean girls are the ones that are hosting these women empowerment events. Tell me, Tisneem, what is most misunderstood about women empowerment? What is the most misunderstood thing?
Patriarchy is really institutionalized in societies. This is not just for, I think it affects Black women more because of our legacy of apartheid. Because transformation hasn't happened as rapidly for Black men either. And so we find ourselves in competition with Black men who feel that why should Black women be given an opportunity when they themselves lack opportunities? And so there's a lot of resistance, by our own community against our own advancement. And Black men often feel, that they've never gotten their turn, so we must wait. It's about really, if you look at the socioeconomic context and you look at reports being done by government, and these are scientific, this is people doing data, this is data-driven information given by the various departments in government, given by corporates, they're forced to give the information. You can't lie about it. And what the reports are saying is that, African and colored women are at the same level of income and education countrywide. So, I mean, you're talking about marginalized, vulnerable people. So those are the people that should be given the leg up. And if enough men that are advancing, then I don't know why black men feel so threatened. I don't know why men in general feel threatened, you know?
Yeah.
What, you know, if they call it a men club or... I honestly, I'm not even going to try, you know, the misunderstanding, because I'm in an age of technology, like I said earlier. People must educate themselves. You know, I paid for my education. So if you can't arrive at that conclusion, I'm going to leave you behind. I'm not going to make it my mission to teach you, you know. So, I mean, I'm just saying, as women, we need to recognize amongst each other that we can't wait for who's going to come and save us. We are the ones that we are waiting for, essentially.
Yeah, no one is coming.
Nobody's coming. No. And nobody's going to make it easy for you. And just because you've made it and it was hard, you also need to, whoever comes after you, you doesn't have to suffer. Doesn't have to go through the hard things because now you've made it, so now you want to lock the door, you know, and not even just close it, but lock it and then be like, you know, that attitude of, well, you know, I suffered and I got you on my own. And nobody gets anywhere in this world on their own, by the way. Nobody.
You know, what you're saying is so significant. I remember on my way here.
Yeah, I have answered you.
Yeah, on my way here, I was listening to a podcast and this lady was saying, if as a mentor, your mentees still have to go through the hoops and the hurdles and cover the same mile that you did, then you wasted your time gaining all that experience and getting all those scars, because they serve nothing. They serve no purpose. So if your mentee still has to experience your heartache, because nothing comes free for anybody, then you've really wasted everybody's time. So I find what you're saying so significant, that the responsibility, and maybe responsibility makes it seem heavy, but if another person coming after you does not have ease, then what have you done?
No, 100%. 100%. Yeah. And I think your story reminds me, and the point you made reminds me of...
We're losing you here and there. I don't know if the network keeps dropping. I don't know if there's anything you can do there, but we keep hearing you and then you disappear and then you come back and da da da.
Sorry, I'm going to try and stand closer to my router.
All right.
Is that better?
Yes.
So what point, you know, and it reminds me, I started university in 1996. And when Fees Must Fall happened, I was reminded that in 1996, in 97, I started law and we started, I became a member of what was then called, and I think they're still called, street law. And what we did was we basically, with the university, we would travel to various townships, Mdansani being one of them, where we would educate the communities on Chapter 2, the Bill of Rights. But to be honest with you, those rights and obligations, when we were not given a manual after April, you know, after 27 April 1994 to tell us as Black South Africans how we were supposed to access and use these Bill of Rights. So when I started in 96, I remember I applied for a TEFSA loan, which is now called NSFIS. And what we should have done then was we should have actually fought for free education. That's what we should have asked for. And so when Fees Must Fall came, I personally said to myself, I failed. If students today are not able to get, it means that I failed. So I felt when the call was made and students were being arrested en masse, I was one of the lawyers that offered to bail students out during the Fees Must Fall protest. And it speaks to what you say, because if we had done what we were supposed to have done when it was our turn, then there's no reason why people should have come and suffered after us. So you're 100% right.
Oh, man. You know? I don't know if this qualifies as a full circle moment, because I was in school when Fees Must Fall first started. In 2015, I think, was the year. And it was such a scary moment. It was such a scary moment. And so for you to be sharing that and realizing, looking back, that they wouldn't be in this situation, in this circumstance, had we actually stood our ground and got exactly what we needed. Shoo. Social entrepreneurship. Yeah. That is an interesting business model. Talk to me about why you went that route. Is it characteristic of the profession you're in, or was it intentionally a decision you made?
Look, I mean, if you look at the concept of social entrepreneurship, it's really philanthropy because you're using the money out of your pocket, right, to do good. You're doing the Lord's work because you're not getting paid for it. But it's fulfilling in a large sense. So I have a lot of students when they come and they say, look, they've got these big ideas when they watch movies and whatever they see on YouTube and social media, etc., about being a human rights lawyer. And I say to them, the first thing you need to do is actually make money. And the only way you're going to make money is if you're excellent. So you need to do not what you think you're passionate about, but what's necessary to advance yourself financially. And because I had the financial freedom, I could venture into that social entrepreneurship because, as an ordinary Black professional, we are not getting the best work from government. We are not getting the commercial deals from corporates. So, who has time now to do good when you can barely, make it through the day survive because
Literally.
you're working to earn money to pay salaries, you're working to pay your car, you're working to pay your bond. You're exhausted, you're tired, you don't have time to go into social entrepreneurship. But it's about living with purpose and about knowing that I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful for everything that God's given me that, and I firmly believe that the best way to worship God is by serving his creation. So what better way to say thank you than to serve God's creation? And in that service, you do find a kind of fulfillment that, you really feel satisfied. You feel like you're paying your rent on this on this planet. You're not just there for the take. You're not just there to grab and to have and to accumulate. You must have enough for yourself. So once you've found your niche, and I was really deliberate about being excellent. That had been instilled in me from a very young age. And my experience during apartheid was that nobody gives Black people free meals, free tickets, free anything. I did benefit from those programs because I remember in 2005 when I applied to, which was then BOE, now Nedbank, I was the bank's first, affirmative action employee. But I mean, I had gone through the psychometric testing and all of the normal stuff. I mean, I think there's an inference that if you are Black, you inferior, which is not the case. There are many, 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 too many Black professionals that are excellent, that are good at what they do. But because we have this stereotype, and amongst ourselves as
Oh,
well,
for sure.
I find, in the community, people when they go to white lawyers, they won't ask for a discount, but the minute they come to me, they'll be like, "Oh, can you give me at least 50?" Not even, "Can I have a discount? Can I have at least 50?" Because the implication is that because it's a Black service, it must cost you less. It must cost you less. But if that same service is being delivered, and we're still shackled by this mindset, unfortunately. And a lot of liberation needs to happen within our own minds, despite the liberation that happened, nearly 30 years ago.
What is the work that you do in your social entrepreneurial endeavor?
So, I mean, like I said, in my role, and I had fulfilled that role for many, many years. I think I've stepped back from leadership roles in the last perhaps 2 years. I was pivotal in running the branch of Black Management Forum in our region, serving as the chair and then provincial chair, and then finally, serving on the board at National, the Black Conveyancers Association. We basically lobbied for Black conveyancers to get onto panels and to get work. And I'm actually now on the Council of Elders. I'm a stalwart. So, unless we get asked for advice and counsel, we kind of leave the youngsters to, we've carved the path, they've got to broaden it. So, I mean, that's the work that I do. And then I'm very, very much involved in Palestinian solidarity work where I basically, I mean, our struggle for emancipation and our struggle against apartheid is the same struggle that's happening now during the genocide in Gaza. So I host a show on a Wednesday where I interview Palestinians from Palestine and the diaspora. And really it's about allowing, or rather hearing people tell their own narrative. I think it's so important that you tell your own story as a people, as a nation. You know, because if you're not going to, someone else is going to come and tell your story for you. So I would say, you know, that and of course I'm very much involved with, you know, student chapters of the Black Management Forum, and just working as in my own private capacity as a mentor to young women and even to young men. You know, I think it's important that we don't, while we must advance women faster and quicker and give them more help, I don't think we should exclude the other gender. You know, we should make space for young men, because, you know, we still have the issue of gender-based violence in this country. I mean, women get killed every 2.5 to 3 hours. You know, our global rate of gender-based violence is 6 times more than anywhere else in the world. So we live in a very violent society. And it's not women abusing women.
No.
It's men abusing women. No. So if we're going to leave that audience out, we're talking to the choir. Nothing's going to change.
This is so true. A friend of mine who's a guy once said something that I'd never thought of, but it really shook me. He said, it's such an injustice to say to women, real men don't abuse, real men don't sexually assault. And he says, the problem with that statement is that you're saying to the woman who has actually encountered abuse at the hand of a man, that it was a cartoon that harassed them, that it was a phantom of their own imagination. No, it's real men who are doing this. And while the sentiment is good, if you really want to take it in, it's also damaging, because then it removes the accountability from actual people who are doing what is so detrimental to women.
Yeah. And I mean, gender-based violence, of course, is the worst. You know, femicide is probably the worst instance of the violence against women. And that is, you know, it's people, you know, it's like unlikely when there's an investigation that you're not going to know who killed that woman, that woman themselves would not have known who the perpetrator was in their last dying moments. You know, so but over and above the extreme of, you know, of femicide, there's the daily grind of the normalization around sexual harassment, especially in the various professions. And I use this example because I say to people, you know, you would not think that someone like me or someone like you could be sexually harassed, because it's not like we're walking down the street and being catcalled. That's not the harassment that we face, but it's like an insidious type of harassment that becomes so normalized that you even forget that it's sexual harassment. So for an example, and I say this loud because this is what happens, this is what I've lived and experienced. You know, you'll have a client, and because the economy is also largely in the hands of men, my client base is not ordinarily women. It's men, because the men are leading the households. They're the CEOs, they're the CFOs, you know, they're the professionals in their family. And when you deliver a service to a man, for some odd reason, in addition to payment, he's expecting a sexual favor. Whereas had he gotten the service from a man and he gets an account, that's it. You pay it and you're done. And you walk away. I mean, that's the transaction. So these things are, you know, it's still happening. You know, how do you deal with it? I just ignore it, because, I mean, honestly, I don't have the energy for that.
Honestly, you know what I want to find out from you, because you hold space for so many people in so many really disparaging situations. And I'm wondering how you learned to hold space for others while still fighting for your own voice, because you are part of the minority you are fighting for.
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up during apartheid, there was a lot of community. And even though we were forced to live in areas by ourselves, but separately. So remember, apartheid was a program of separation, not just separating black people from white people, but even separating, more importantly, black people from each other. So I'm very big on unity. I'm very big on black unity. I'm very big on, as women, as you know, we must be together. We must be together, because it's like I said, it goes back to what I said. These are not, I am enjoying the fruits of people who have died not having tasted the fruits of the seeds of the tree that they grew. So I do not want my grandchildren to say, you know, to me, but Grandma, where were you when this was happening? What did you say? What did you do? Why are we still experiencing femicide? Why are we still experiencing sexual harassment in the workplace? Yeah. Why are we as Black people still poor? Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, for me, it's just, and it's something that I do unthinkingly. It's not something that I like, you know, it's a default thought that I, you know, I've rooted in my gratitude for. If I look at the class of my peers when we were in high school or matriculated, I can count probably on one hand, two hands if I'm lucky, how many of us survived apartheid? How many of us survived going through, you know, the violence of gangsterism, etc.? And I was the one who made it. And how did I make it? I made it through the grace of God. It wasn't just my own doing. So really, it goes back to what I said. I root myself in how do I worship my maker? And for me, it's serving his creation. How do I please him? I serve his creation. So that's really my anchor. That's what I turn to unknowingly, knowingly. And I must tell you, it's not perfect on all days. Of course, we waver. And sometimes I think, you know what? I can't do this anymore. I'm battling here, even for myself. But I revert back to that. I make that my natural essence because that's what I firmly believe in.
Yeah.
And it's because I've benefited from you know, our forebears who fought this fight for us, unselfishly, not thinking, what are they going to get out of it? Are they even going to see it? But they knew that liberation was important. They didn't know when it was going to happen, but they knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And they knew that that was going to be for the betterment of all South Africans, you know, present, future, and future. So I think, you know, that is a value that I've just instilled in myself that has been instilled in me through the various organizations that, you know, I was fortunate enough to be company secretary to Ntati Mohale, Bonang Mohale. So, you know, these are real stalwarts of the country who lived properly through the brutality and the violence of apartheid. And, you know, to have them as mentors really and the humility that they have, you know, these people are not filled with self-importance and to see them serve and give so much of themselves and continue to, that's inspirational to me.
Sure.
So I can't ascribe, you know, I think, you know, you become who you spend the greater part of your time with. So despite the fact that I did this volunteering, you know, transformation work and my family, you know, I sacrificed, I don't know how many birthdays of my daughter I missed going you know, being at meetings, etc., out of town. And I did benefit, and the sacrifice cannot have been for nothing, cannot have been in vain. So, yeah.
What is one belief you had to outgrow in order to become the woman you are now?
You know, because I'm so confident, I think that for me, being decisive was important, and I think in being decisive, sometimes I'm hasty. I'm too fast for my own good. I won't think things through. Yeah. So for me, a bad decision is better than no decision.
I resonate with that so much.
Procrastination. I've made many bad decisions.
What do you mean procrastination?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, you do not want to be, you know, sort of in this animated state or the state of animation where nothing moves. So I think for me, something that I've really, and it comes with age, by the way, I'm not as impatient as I used to be 10 years ago. That much I can tell you. So it's the impatience that I've had, you know, impatiently wanting to be successful, impatiently wanting to make money, impatiently wanting to achieve goals. And there are no shortcuts in life. You know, there are no shortcuts. So I think that's the one thing, the you know, having patience.
Yeah.
When I'm not a person of patience, that's something that I constantly have to tell myself, just move slowly and breathe deeply and, you know, just wait, just pause, just pause. So, yeah, I think for me, off the cuff, that's one thing that I've had to learn, to not be so impatient.
Yeah. Tasneem, when you think of the women you advocate for, what breaks your heart the most?
I think a lot of times we advocate for people, you know, in speaking events or wherever, mm-hmm. who are not actually even in the room, who don't even have access to the spaces that we occupy. So for me, you know, on many Women's Day events, I get asked to speak and I look at the women and they're fairly accomplished. They're not the really most vulnerable of the most vulnerable. So for me, it's, you know, how do we then reach those communities? What do we do? Are we making an effort to find these people that we're advocating for? And how are we then, you know, how are we then ensuring that the work we do is impactful, that it really reaches that segment of society and not just hitting people that don't really need. Yes, I feel inspirational for the day, but then their lives carry on. I was very, very fortunate also to be part of a group of advocates who visited Bangladesh in 2017 during the Rohingya genocide. And this year, through my work with Gift of the Givers, I had visited Syria and I really visited refugee camps. And I must tell you that despite seeing poverty in South Africa, I had experienced and seen poverty far worse in those refugee camps. So I also think that, you know, it's important, you know, that, and it's unfortunate that you have to go like out the country to see levels of poverty when it's not that hard. But I mean, because of geographical apartheid and spatial apartheid, we our kids don't see poverty. Sure. You know, when we grew up, we had people knocking in the door and we used to call them sticky brood, knocking, asking for water and bread. You don't, complexes, you can't, a postman can't even come in from South African post office. And when we drive past, I mean, barring the few beggars, you're not seeing really the level of poverty that gives you that, or should give you that kind of empathy that, that moves you into action. And that will move your kids into action because they get whatever they want. So they don't understand poverty in the same terms that I'm explaining it to you. Because you know what I'm talking about. So, you know, I think getting involved in organizations or contributing, if you can't personally get involved, which a lot of us can't maybe do, or maybe we feel unsafe, it's just to make sure you do that homework and you really see, you know, which organizations are doing the good work. And a lot of organizations post-Trump's era are now closed down, shut down, because USAID offices have been closed, you know, throughout South Africa. So I think there's a space to contribute in that way. To ensure, because I mean, we were featured, and I'm not sure how many years ago, not too long ago, on Time magazine as the most unequal country in the world. I mean, that's not something you want to make the cover of a magazine for.
No.
And that continuous, you know, widening of inequality is what will cause civil unrest, and we saw this previously. In this country. So we really need to guard against that. And the fact that we eat every night shouldn't make us not wonder about the people out there who are not having regular meals, who are not eating. We should be concerned about people who don't have. Whilst we have.
Finally, if your life were a book, what would tonight's chapter be titled? Or maybe not tonight, but this season of your life.
Are you saying what must the chapter be called?
What would the chapter of this season of your life be called? You can even tell me about the book itself.
No, I think really to me, the chapter, because I'm a bit of a drama queen, I think mine would be Thank You God with like three exclamation marks, because I honestly want to fall to my knees when I think about my life and where I am versus where I could have easily been. So yeah, thank you, God, that that could be the chapter of that unknown book. In the writing.
I love it. You know, tonight you reminded us that power is not always loud. Sometimes it's really steady. It is principled. It's disciplined. And like you kept mentioning almost in every response, that it is deeply rooted in service. You know, you really spoke to us about the fact that the world changes and it doesn't only change through protest and policy, but through the everyday courage of women, of men who dare to live beyond what society expected. And you know, I just asked about a chapter right now in your life, but hearing you speak, I'm just like, no, man, this is a powerful woman. in just these 40 minutes, you've poured out your journey like a map. And I think every woman who's trying to find her way can get what do they call them on the map? Is it milestones or markers? But whatever it is, for themselves. You talked about what your dad instilled in you, the decisions you've had to make along the way, what you don't want to hear future generations ever saying about you or your generation. That is, thank you so much. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your life. Thank you for your story. Thank you for your unrelenting heart and the work that you continue to do. And I know you will keep doing until at least one part of the story that you have in your mind is completely, completely done and completely resolved. Thank you so much for your service. And I know in America they say this to vets, but I'm going to say it to you tonight because I really believe that the work you are doing is sacred. It is beautiful. It is life-changing. And today you graciously offered the story to us. I'm very, very grateful for that, for having had this conversation with you.
Thank you so much, Mpumi. And yeah, I look forward to also, I mean, I Googled you as well, and you're doing great things. So I wouldn't be a lawyer if I didn't. So
am I on
Thank
Google?
You. I feel honored. I really feel honored. It was a huge gift to me at the end of the year. This is like an early Christmas gift. I don't celebrate Christmas, but I do accept gifts. So thank you for this gift of just sharing. And you know, you not often, unless you get prodded, you don't often reflect and you don't often celebrate because you're not looking back. You're so focused on, you know, getting to, you know, to a bigger, better milestone. You're just climbing the whole time. You're not thinking and really pausing to celebrate. So thank you for reminding me. I mean, in telling you, I was reminded.
This is a power and gift of conversation, right? You get to see your story completely different. Well, maybe not completely.
Loved every minute. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming through. Have a lovely evening.
Thanks, you too. Thank you. All right.
Oh, and that wraps another successful week of Business Sense. Hey, the devil tried to rock us, but we were like, no, we're doing this. And I'm so glad that we did. Thank you so much for tuning in every day, or even if you didn't tune in every day, but thank you so much for sticking with us. I am Nompumelelo Mbonani, and I hope that you have made sense of your business. Fresh mercies tomorrow. Ciao for now.
Adventist World Radio, from broadcast to baptism, powered by SID Media.